You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we're thrilled to be joined today by one of our favorite Third Pelton brothers, a lifelong fan of the Seahawks as well as various other NFL teams, who also runs the NFL draft website, 3sigmaathlete.com. Here to help us preview this Thursday's draft, please welcome to the podcast, Zach Whitman.
Hey, wait, what was that bit about me being a fan of various other NFL teams?
Well, you were a lifelong Panthers fan for a while.
Oh, okay,
there.
And, okay, yeah. Yes. Well, yeah. My lifelong allegiance to the Packers, Panthers, and every other NFC team aside, I am a Seahawks fan.
Still one of my favorite bits. But sadly, that is not what we are here to discuss today. Actually, this could be like an hour-long breakdown of the schedule. That would be a great podcast.
Can I say that it just in general, reacting to Twitter mostly from the outside over the last few weeks, it's an amazing feeling of like Rome is burning to see the entire team somewhat getting raised down and longtime players leaving. But then there are still like four people on Seahawks Twitter who are like piecing together the schedule like it's Westworld clues or something. The stakes don't seem that high to me. I don't know. But I do appreciate the get up and go that people are still showing.
You're viewing them as the "this is fine" meme?
I don't know if it's denial or if those people actually have a more pure appreciation for the sport than I do, because I actually respect the end result that they're just in the you know, just digging and they're keeping going. But for me, I'm just looking around and everything is actually bad. And it seems less important if we start with two road games, but regardless, I'm way off the direction here.
Maybe those people just have a real appreciation for scheduling.
My approach to the schedule has always been the same as the classic, possibly apocryphal Larry Bird quote, where he checked out the schedule and was like, 41 home, 41 away, looks good to me. But this year, the Seahawks actually don't have 8 home and home, 8 away. They've only got 7 road games, so that seems like a win to me.
Does that get canceled out by the fact that you have to travel to London? That seems...
Yeah, that they've replaced the shortest road trip possible in the NFL with the longest possible one. Not ideal, but at least they didn't have to give up a home game to play in London. So I think that's the upside. But anyways, that is not this podcast. We are instead here to talk about the NFL draft and specifically probably to talk a lot about the SPARC metric for rating player athleticism. Zach, for the listener who did not listen to last year's podcast with you and is maybe not familiar with SPARC, what can you tell us about the background and how you kind of got into using it?
Yeah, so this is weirdly, I think 5 drafts ago, we kind of got into this. It was making its way around Seahawks Twitter at the time, right after the Super Bowl win, which feels very weird to hear that was 5 drafts ago and the Seahawks were actually winning a Super Bowl, maybe 6 now. But it basically, I think the easiest way to explain is probably the SAT for football. The way it was developed was for high school athletes testing out. Much when Pete Carroll was at USC, you put a bunch of athletic measures in, you know, like the 40-yard dash or the vertical jump or other things, and use those to kind of get a composite idea of a player's athleticism. So the idea being you test out, you don't look at, you know, every single individual tick on the 40 because it's really hard to know what a 4.55 or a 4.45 or anything mean. And then you extrapolate that to what does an offensive lineman do? What does a defensive lineman do? What numbers do we need? So what I've developed basically is a way of using SPARC, back calculating what they used for the initial Nike stuff back 10 or 15 years ago, and trying to create position independent scoring where we know kind of at offensive tackle or at defensive line or whatever it may be, you kind of know where a player ranks relative to the NFL average. The way I would probably sum it up, and I think probably my best bit at summing it up overall, the way I use athleticism in the NFL draft, is that when you look back at NFL history, I don't think you see a one-to-one relationship between athleticism and success at all. And we shouldn't assume that a really great athlete is going to be a really great player. But in general, very, very few poor athletes end up being good players. Most great players are great athletes. But we can't assume that just good testers are good athletes. So I would say the good process is evaluating analytics athletically, as well as production, age, and trying to kind of use all of these best practices we can to be, you know, 5% better at the draft maybe than someone else, which in the NFL, is probably, you know, puts you close to the top.
So you mentioned Pete Carroll's relationship to this at USC. How much have you seen the Seahawks use these spark metrics or sort of, you know, what they end up doing in the draft line up with this? And has that evolved at all over time? And also, have you seen other teams use it more over time?
Yeah, I think I have a different view on this maybe than conventional wisdom here. And I think the Seahawks have always valued athleticism at specific positions more than others, and in specific roles even more than just positions. And so I'm not actually sure their use of athleticism has varied much over time. Pete Carroll was really involved early on with the development at Nike and at USC. And certainly early on, you can think of players in the Seahawks like Bobby Wagner, who were kind of, you know, smaller school guys who tested out of the gym athletically. And some of those early classes, especially 2012, was probably the most athletic draft class on record. But in recent years, they've definitely taken some players who are less athletic, but they have tended to kind of be those years where their positions, the Seahawks have never really valued athleticism, such as free safety with Tedrick Thompson last year. But the Seahawks still kind of where they want their athleticism. I think they've actually shown really similar aspects. I do think that their draft strategy has changed somewhat the last few years in that they have decided that the most undervalued asset is a player with a health risk. And, you know, your mileage may vary whether you think that's been successful or not in the way you're identifying talent. Now, as to other teams that have used it, there have been a lot of teams to kind of change, and especially over the period I've been looking at, which is 5 years, we've gone from the Pittsburgh Steelers picking, you know, the least athletic players to consistently picking some of the most athletic players every year, as well as the Dallas Cowboys about 3 years ago went through kind of a transformation where they really started picking athletes everywhere, you know, from high draft picks like Byron Jones in the secondary to kind of more relative unknowns like David Irving on the defensive line, who was, you know, an undrafted free agent for the entire process, was kind of overlooked, but popped athletically and just ended up being a Cowboy along with a lot of other athletes.
So I think an interesting discussion to have here is you mentioned kind of trying to be 5% better than other teams and how important that can be in the NFL draft. Do we think at this point the Seahawks are good at drafting?
So I think it's a complex question. So to one, I think that the last few years they've been extremely high variance drafting. And I think part of that is born out of the relatively low draft capital they've had. They tried to hit a lot of home runs. They're going after guys who have been injured. They're going after people who maybe didn't have the best senior season, the last season in the school. And a lot of those guys have not worked out. Now, would that happen every time? No. And is it fair to judge somebody just on the results? Probably not. But their results have not been good. I guess what I would say is that I do not fall into like the Chase Stewart who runs football perspective. He believes that essentially no one is good at the draft. I think that there are people who are better at the draft, but we probably don't have a sample size that's large enough to actually show the true talent level of any given evaluator. So I think the Seahawks are good at evaluating talent, but they have not been picking good players for 4 or 5 years. And it really begs the question, I guess, for me, the nature and nurture thing. I think a big part of the reason they're not developing defensive talent is because they've had defensive players on the roster playing. And I wonder how much of it all along was the fact that those young players back in 2011, 2012, kind of in the heyday, were going to play right away, big minutes. And so it does make me wonder, you know, we could see a bounce back, maybe players coming in when they're being relied on from day one, because that is something we haven't seen in recent years. I mean, are these guys that come in really going to play as well if they don't have time to get there and go? I mean, the best defensive rookie the Seahawks had in years is I guess, Shaq Griffin or Frank Clark, both of whom had kind of an obvious place from day one to play, as well as being, you know, second and third round picks. So and this is a long-winded question to, I guess I would sum up as, one, I don't think they're bad at drafting, but two, they've been bad at drafting results-wise. And I think that a lot of that could be the lack of opportunity and the interplay between what is coaching and development and what is drafting. And it probably was wrong to say the drafting was so good in 11-12 when a lot of it was about opportunity and coaching. But it's probably also wrong to say that the drafting has been so poor the last few years and not blame the fact that there's no obvious role for many of these players to go into.
That's interesting, though. Do you feel like the chance that you're talking about how the last couple of years their strategy has changed a little bit from being a little bit less in the focus of athleticism to being a little bit more looking for what I guess I would consider like regression to the mean guys, players who are injured, players who had down senior seasons. It's hard to tell, I suppose, whether, you know, the question about opportunity. But the drafts that we consider these great drafts that they had early on were almost completely these athleticism drafts. And the regression drafts that have been more recent haven't had as many players that have broken out of it. Do you feel like that's a coincidence, or because of the opportunity available, or because the strategy has changed?
Well, I think it's really hard to draft for a team that's almost certainly complete, because when your team has almost no one on it, like going back to the 11 or 12 Seahawks, you're drafting really good players and there's opportunity for them regardless. So I think it is by circumstance just much more difficult to fill in a roster when you are hiring for one very specific skill set. If I open a business tomorrow and I need 10 different skill sets and I have 5 applications, it's very possible that I could hire all of them and find places for them. It may be very tough to find the one guy who fits the exact thing that you need for a given role. So I think that a lot of it is that opportunity, honestly. I also think the strategy hasn't changed that much, except that they are trying to find the next undervalued asset. And the most publicly obvious parameter we have that seems to be that undervalued asset is the injury or regression, right? Regression to me, as you're saying. I also wonder, though, if there's almost other cycles in this where they're doing other analytics we don't have access to, analytics based on flexibility, injury, mental testing. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here I think we actually don't see. And so I think it's very hard to evaluate what they've changed approach-wise because we don't have quite enough data to actually know what they're doing. I'm of the mind that teams are actually doing a lot more than we see, the smart teams. And they might have done a 2 or 3 year study on a certain personality thing that we would never know about that could be something that just didn't pan out. I personally believe that they picked a bunch of guys that were injured in 2016, and it turned out those guys oftentimes stayed injured or were not very good. And that was unfortunate. And I do hope they somewhat do not go so whole hog on that approach. I think balance is still pretty important here. And I want to see a bunch of guys across the spectrum. As far as athleticism and changing the mindset, I think they still pick athletic positions. And I keep referring to that. But I would say the Seahawks athletic positions are often like wide receiver in certain ways, tight end. They all have very athletic tight ends. Some positions along the offensive line, edge rushers, linebackers, but not necessarily safeties or fullbacks or right guards. So I think that they've picked a lot of positions where they have not valued athleticism recently, and that's why it looks smaller. But I actually think they still like to see athleticism in a lot of their depth guys on defense and a lot of their depth guys on offense for special teams, as well as the roles that we see. So to sum all of that up that we just said, I would say, one, I think athleticism still matters to them, but they have found other things they hope are their edge over other teams. It just turns out that those really have not panned out in the last few years.
Well, and I think, you know, to your point about trying to determine what they're doing from the outside, it's sort of the same problem that you mentioned in terms of evaluating how good teams are at drafting. Like, it's a limited sample size. And we only see, you know, the 7 to 15 players that you end up picking in the actual draft. We don't get to see teams' entire boards unless they accidentally reveal them on Twitter. So, you know, they could be super high on someone who happens to go a couple picks ahead of them, and we just don't know anything about that preference. But I think your take on their ability to draft overall is a really good one. And I think that, you know, you kind of summed it up well with this idea that I am confident that probably there are some teams that are good and bad at drafting. Like, the Browns probably are bad at drafting, or have been historically. Like, we'll see, because it's a new regime going forward. Although I don't know if I'm super encouraged about what they're going to do with the first and fourth picks in this year's draft. But, you know, there's so much randomness involved in any individual draft pick in terms of their health, in terms of, you know, their fit, in terms of, you know, if you have coaching changes and change schemes and then players don't, you know, look as good as they are. I mean, you look at no further than Jared Goff the last couple of years as an example of how much more goes into the success or failure of a player that you've drafted than just their inherent talent or their ability. And then Malik McDowell is maybe kind of the ultimate example of this, where we have no idea whether that was a good draft pick or not. It's sadly, it seems like we're never going to find out whether that actually made sense.
Yeah, I mean, that he's the canonical case of results and process, right? I actually like the process that led Malik McDowell. I mean, if you tell me that you were able to, from his character and his taking a snap off on second down, it, you know, was able to tell you that he would take an ATV and give himself serious brain damage, I mean, kudos to you, but I don't know. That seems a little bit like your wish casting your own ability. Gosh, that sucks, doesn't it? Have we talked about this? That really sucks, that Malik Bell stuff. I'm still coping with that.
It sucks. There's not really much else you can say, but it sucks. Okay, so what do we think are positions of need for the Seahawks in this year's draft?
Well, I feel like the fact that they only have, they still only have what, like the fewest players in the league on the roster. It's like the low 70s or something, maybe. It feels like this is the first year, with the exception of quarterback, you know, pending the opinion of Seahawks Twitter, there's really ability everywhere. Because even in positions like offensive line, where you think maybe they were spending a lot of money, most of those contracts could be out after next year pretty easily. The entire defense really needs a ton of depth at really every position, you know, partly because of the Dell unfortunate situation. And then they have an incredibly limited skill set of skill players. I mean, it is pretty shocking. If you look at the roster right now, you print it out, you get some highlighters out, you look at the different positions. Another thing I've actually done, because this is on paper and it's been a while since I've actually printed something. But if you actually look at who's on the depth chart at wide receiver right now, it is pretty bare. It is crying out for someone of the caliber of a Jermaine Kearse, maybe just someone to get targets and to catch some passes. So I actually think that probably counter to some people, while I do think everything's in need, I think there's a really significant need at wide receiver that we're not addressing yet because of what's going to happen potentially next offseason with Tyler Lockett. And then I think there's a really, really a huge need on defense just to get younger. It's been a long time. They haven't drafted a linebacker for 4 years. They drafted, five safeties last year, whatever it was, but they don't seem to actually love any of those players enough to play them. And they've brought Brevin McDougal back for I think $3.5 million next season. So I would probably, my ideal situation going in would be to actually take a wide receiver in the first few picks, and then just really hit defensive depth hard. I'm not sure that there's a ton of offensive line depth in this class beyond like the first round or two that I'd be super excited about. So I know that people will dislike that, but I'm not sure I see a huge amount of value being gained from spending a ton of capital on offensive line this year.
So what positions do you think are particularly strong in this year's draft?
Well, I think there's a few different ways to answer that. Certainly, the Seahawks don't have a lot of draft capital. So what I've been kind of focusing on is almost less of depth of positions and more positions where I think there are players undervalued because where the players analytically who are kind of popping are not the players who are going to get drafted high. But I think that there is a really huge depth of athleticism at linebacker that you often don't see. As it seems like for the last few years, there are a lot of corners who tested well. It's not quite last year, but there's a lot out there. And then I do think that, well, I think a lot of people have been negative on the wide receiver class. There are a lot of guys you can get late there maybe who actually show some really good indicators that I'd be pretty excited about in like the fourth round, fifth round even. And a lot of times wide receivers in those rounds don't really pan out too much. But the kind of player you're getting this year I think is actually going to be really exciting.
Well, that's good news because the Seahawks don't pick again until the fourth round.
wait, but before you ask that, I'm curious who some of those wide receivers are that you think the Seahawks might be targeting in those later rounds.
Do we want to get into this? So I guess I should introduce, I don't know if you guys are either of you familiar with John Moore's work at RotoViz. He's mostly retired from writing now, but he has this thing called the Phenom Index, and it's essentially an age-adjusted production. And I would say it predicts results essentially about as well as any metric for any position in football. It does a really good job of kind of taking it. And so you can, instead of having to kind of mentally figure out what a 24-year-old player should be doing or a 22-year-old player or a 20-year-old player, it does a really good job of adjusting for those. And he gives this phenom rating at the end. And so you can kind of look and production at wide receiver correlates with NFL success more than any other position. Now, it's tough to make that argument to some extent because we don't have production that's easy to calculate for, like, cornerbacks, really. But of the, you know, the skill positions that have the easy counting stats, wide receivers, really good wide receivers in college are typically going to, you know, correlate better to the NFL. And the player that I'm really kind of smitten with is Justin Watson from Penn. He's the second highest rated by John Moore in the Phenom Index, as well as being a really plus athlete. He's projected to go in the sixth round. Now, I would say that based on his testing, you're actually going to see him go higher, and I wouldn't be surprised to see a fourth-round pick there. I don't think he's going to go quite in the sixth round pick that he's projected right now. But that's a guy that really pops to me. Other ones that I'd be interested, although maybe a little less interested, Antonio Callaway, who's projected in the seventh to a free agent, really a productive player and kind of a league average athlete, which I would be completely happy with. A guy like Cedric Wilson out of Boise State, projected in the fifth and sixth round. A guy like Trey Quinn out of Southern Methodist. James Washington from Oklahoma State, somehow going projected to go in the third round. I really think he's a nice, solid prospect, relatively young, and would be a pretty fun fit in Seattle. Just there's a lot of those guys where in a lot of cases in the drafts, you see that the guys who are productive and young go early. For this year, for whatever reason, there's a bunch of players who are productive going in the fifth, sixth, seventh round projected that I'm pretty excited about.
Oh, that's really strange. I wonder if maybe the like draft, mock draft intelligentsia is not able to have caught up as much with the way that NFL teams are looking at players, or this is what they're hearing. I'm curious if maybe players that are coming up really good at both Spark scores and with a phenom rating will get drafted higher, like maybe even by a couple rounds, than what we're seeing in places like mock drafts and places like that.
I think that what I've noticed is that the production stuff is typically weighted already in to the mock drafts when we see them just kind of at the start of the season. And then the athletic testing will bump you up a round or two, you know, from the sixth round to the fourth round or whatever it may be. But you almost never see age accounted for in any of that. And so the real discount you get is by probably avoiding an older player until a little bit later and getting a younger player a little bit earlier, because those are kind of seen very similarly by kind of draft intelligentsia. Whereas you're looking at something like Phenom Index, it actually will tell you, you know, if there's a 24-year-old player you should be drafting, and where to do that. But obviously the bigger value there is kind of isolating the younger players. And I will say, to this point, DJ Moore from Maryland, who the Seahawks will have no chance of drafting, is just an incredible athlete, one of the top ones in the class, has one of the best phenom ratings ever, up there with like Larry Fitzgerald.
Wow.
And like there's a list of like five all pros in the seven players he fits into list wise. I think the only player who's not an elite player is Kenny Britt, from the list of these guys. So we should be really hoping DJ Moore does not end up in Arizona, San Francisco, etc.
You can almost guarantee that's happening now.
Yeah, sorry.
Don't speak it into existence.
Well, let's say that that's more of a 2018 fantasy football prediction. I'm curious about one player. I don't know if you know anything about him, but he's in your top 10 for Spark wide receivers, Vincent Smith, and mostly because I have never heard of the college that he went to, Limestone University.
I know nothing about Vincent Smith, although the fact that his name is spelled quite eccentrically, and I want to know the story behind it. For those listening, V-Y-N-C-I-N-T, and then of course with a first name like that, you have to have kind of Smith as your last name, just so it doesn't get too confused.
Limestone is definitely deep enough that Luca, baby fantasy genius, does not know their nickname.
For the record, I'm Googling right now. It's a private four-year co-educational liberal arts college located in Gaffney. Their mascot is the St. Bernard, which does sound awesome.
Okay. I'm teaching you fantasy genius that.
They play D2 in the Conference Carolinas, which is not something I had ever heard of. All right. So as I alluded to earlier, the Seahawks don't have a pick between the first round and the fourth round in this year's draft due to Lemony Snicket's a series of unfortunate trades. What do we think are the odds that the Seahawks trade back in the first round, as they seemingly always do, to try to replenish those picks?
I don't want to come on this podcast and say anything's 100% because I'm just gonna get made fun of. But it does feel like it's like 90-95%. I mean, it's incredibly hard to imagine they stick not having a second and third round pick, especially with people have been talking about this trade down with the Browns consistently. And this is the rare occasion where I think Seahawks Twitter, you know, or Twitter at large just in general, probably actually has it right. I think it's very likely that they go with a trade down and very possibly a trade down with the Browns to 33.
I mean, it's interesting. Historically, often what they've done in terms of moving all the way down to the second round is kind of a series of trades where you go down five picks and that way, you know, you're confident that your player is still going to be on the board. And then another five picks when, you know, the group of players that you're interested in are still on the board. But Cleveland has so much draft capital that it might make it appealing to make that jump all at once.
Right. Well, it's also hard normally in the draft to make a trade down that far because other teams don't have enough capital to trade up. Right. Cleveland having that capital means they essentially can make any jump wherever they want it, and it actually makes sense potentially for the team trading down. So it's kind of a weird situation with them this year. But I mean, I would be happy to have, you know, some of those picks, because I don't think it's good practice to go from having the 18th pick to the 100th something pick. That seems bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a whole series area of the draft where if you like players in that area, they're just completely closed off to you. So that can't be exciting if you're a general manager.
It's got to be excruciating, right, to go 48 hours between picks, whatever it is. I mean, I can't even imagine what that would be like just watching every single player you go, because the drop off from like the mid fourth and late is really where the draft starts to tail off. And that early fourth is still pretty good. But the Seahawks would just be completely, completely sunk, because they're only then picking all but one player are in really the dregs of the draft, where you're getting down to priority free agency essentially pretty quickly. So I really hope they trade down and at least get a few picks kind of in that viable range before, you know, pick 110 or so. But if they're picking everything after that, it's going to be kind of rough.
Well, we're on the topic of trades. What do we think are the chances that we see an Earl Thomas trade before or during the draft?
I don't know if I can be relied upon to reliably talk about this. Someone asked me this week, and I thought, like, even a few weeks ago, it kind of felt like an even odds thing. It feels like this week, with maybe I'm being Pollyanna, I feel like the McDougald stuff felt fairly solid. Like maybe he's going to stay. So I will be optimistic, and I'm going to give you 2/3 he stays, 1/3 he goes.
I'll take it.
It's amazing. That's the optimistic stance.
It is, right? I can't. It would wreck me. That would be very, very hard.
Let's move on now and maybe talk about some specific prospects who have been linked to the Seahawks, players who have appeared frequently in mock drafts. We'll start with the most popular skill position player, I'd say.
Oh, no.
LSU running back Darius Geis.
Yeah. I mean, we can pretend like, you know, Ben Guga is not factoring in here, but I feel like, you know, he's kind of casting a pall. Guga from Seahawks Twitter. I would be pretty surprised to see them go with a running back at 18. I would be despondent to see them go with a running back at 18. And so I'm essentially pretending that it won't happen. And it really has gone well for me so far. And I wouldn't say like there's anything wrong with him necessarily. I mean, he tested kind of okay. I will say, in terms of historically, he had extremely bad vertical and broad jumps, to the extent where, like, in the 20 years of data we have, I think there's been 3 good running backs with jumps, you know, even kind of close to where his were, and one of those is Leon Washington. So he was kind of on the lower bound of testing, where we really haven't seen a lot of success stories. But also, he's a running back, and so that's kind of my opposition to him altogether, and I don't really let myself think about the other reasons I don't like him. I do think it's kind of stupid, all this nebulous character stuff that's dinging him for some reason, because it feels completely random and arbitrary.
First off, please refer to him as Seahawks legend Leon Washington.
Okay. I mean, he is a part of the probably part of the greatest gif in Seahawks history of Brandon Browner like blowing up 3 Cardinals while Leon Washington watched in amazement.
I don't think I remember that one. I'm going to have to dig that up.
Okay, this is a classic.
So the thing with Darius Geis is not only that it would be a train wreck to draft a running back in the first round or with their first selection in the draft, wherever that may come, it's that he's not even a very good running back to begin with.
I mean, I don't think you can say that. He may very well be a good running back. The problem is he's lauded as the safe choice, and all the safe running backs in the first round appear to be bad in the last, you know, 8 years. So I'd be very leery. We are not good at evaluating running backs at all. And so I just don't understand why you'd pay a lot of draft capital to take a position that we don't actually know how to evaluate.
I think we're all in the same position there. And yeah, definitely one of my rules of thumb in the NBA draft is there's no such thing as a safe prospect. And if you're taking someone because they're the safe prospect, they're probably not. Okay, next on the list of players linked to the Seahawks, Notre Dame tackle Mike McGlinchey.
Mike McGlinchey didn't test. Except with some jumps, the vertical and broad jump, which were fine, and he's not significantly overaged. This falls into, you know, kind of the middle first, and I am more than happy with, you know, as long as players are just not super old and super unathletic on the offensive line, to trust the offensive line coach, who, by the way, is not Thomas Lee Carroll, Cable Jr. Well, there's a Freudian slip calling him Thomas Carroll. But you know, I mean, I'm fine with that. I would say my preferred offensive tackle choice, kind of in that range, if they're going, is Connor Williams from Texas, who's really, really young, was a star as a freshman and sophomore, but had an injury and was kind of coming back from that last year. So I'd probably prefer to see him. But if they pick an offensive tackle high, I'm okay with McGlinchey or Williams.
The other offensive linemen linked to the Seahawks are more interior, which seems to be perhaps a bit more of a need after the addition of Dwayne Brown. So we'll start with someone you were tweeting about earlier Sunday night, UTEP guard Will Hernandez.
Yeah, Will Hernandez. So this is one of my favorites. This is one of the weird draft Twitter things where people get really obsessed about arm length without actually looking to see if arm length, you know, over time, what it means and kind of what the limits are. You know, one of the things about having an athleticism database and measurements is not just what's an overall, you know, profile, but kind of what are the specific things that make up a given profile. Are there offensive guards with short arms like Will Hernandez who have been good in the past? And as I tweeted earlier tonight, there are. This is pretty frustrating because back in 2015, the Seahawks, a lot of us wanted the Seahawks to take Shaq Mason, I believe in the fourth round. And I think he went the pick or two after Terry Poole in that round. But Will Hernandez has the 32-inch arms, which is basically a Seahawk corner, not really an offensive lineman, where typically you're seeing 33, 34-inch arms. But there are a lot of guards who have 32-inch arms and have been successful. It's not that crazy. He's a really good athlete. He's not overaged. I think he's in the top 10 athletically for his position. People love his tape. So I'd be pretty excited. I mean, I don't like spending a lot of high picks on guards, but if he were able to fall into the second round and they had to have an offensive lineman, I'd be as happy with him as, you know, any other interior lineman.
Important aside, do you know what Shaq Mason's middle name is?
I actually don't.
Elijahwan. Shaquille Elijahwan Mason.
That is excellent.
That's an amazing name.
I feel much better now that I know that. That is great.
Okay, the other guard who has been linked to the Seahawks in a number of mock drafts from Georgia, Isaiah Wynn.
Yeah, he has not actually tested. I think there were some injury issues going on there, and it's really tough then to feel that out. I will say that he's projected to go in the first round, and it seems insane to me to take a guard who's too injured to test in the first round. But I have no other real take beyond that. I guess, he has kind of like the arm length. He's more prototypical of what you want. But if you're picking him over, Hernandez because of arm length, I don't think you're actually doing a good job of looking in the data and seeing what things mean. Now, if you think he's a better player and you think he performs better, he's going to be more coachable, the litany of reasons you could take him, that's fine. I'm not gonna argue there. I'm not an offensive line expert, but I don't see his arm length of 1 3 inches greater being a deal, you know, just a winner, and you have to take him in the first round as a guard. Seems a little high.
Moving to the defensive side of the ball, edge rusher Harold Landry from Boston College.
I'd be really excited about Harold Landry. Really the goal, I would say, is to take a lot of players who either defend the pass or are part of the pass game on offense, and that fits in here. I would love to have more edge rushing. He really fits into like a Jerry Hughes, 250-pound edge rusher role. Really good tester and really good in all the right ways, where he's really agile, has a pretty good 10 split, a lot of things that are useful in an edge player. So I think he just tests well, he tests correctly, and he'd be an awesome fit to replace Cliff Averill. So if they do stick at 18, that's probably one of the names I'd be most happy to see there, is an actual edge rusher with all the pedigree, not super overaged and tested well.
The buzz is that he's supposedly moving up, whatever that means at this point in the draft process.
I think that just means he's an edge rusher. it feels like they always go a little higher than they're supposed to. So I would be surprised to see him there at 18. Guys with his profile tend to go top 15, but such is life.
I think the most common player to the Seahawks in recent mock drafts has been Iowa cornerback Josh Jackson.
Yeah, so Josh Jackson is interesting to me because he's really athletic, and I think people have gotten that down. Like, everyone who's mocking for the Seahawks is like, ooh, they like athletic corners. The only issue I see there is the Seahawks have not still, all these years later, they do not draft players with short arms. And not that his are insanely short, and this is the opposite story of what I was saying at offensive line, but he is 6 foot with 31-inch arms. And they have made a strict rule. I think they've drafted like 8 or 9 or something corners, maybe 7. And all of them have had significantly longer arms than 31, all over 32, and many of them significantly more than that. So I guess I would be surprised, one, because the Seahawks don't spend early picks on corners, and people have mocked them doing so the last 2 or 3 years, you know, kind of in anticipation. I don't think it's a corner class is even as deep as last year. I don't think after kicking Shaq Griffin last year, they're that desperate. They need to take somebody who doesn't fit their prototype that early. And it sure seems like he's going to go in the first, 40 picks at least. And I really would be kind of odd to me to see them spend their only high pick if they were to stay up there on the corner.
Do you read anything into the fact that they signed Dante Johnson last week, who has, it was listed at 31.5-inch arms?
Yeah, so I would say, first of all, the margin of error on arm length is in 3/8 to 1/2-inch range. So actually, 31.5, I somewhat believe, depending on who's measuring it, it could be more or less. But they actually do have a history of signing players whose arms are shorter than 32, significantly so.
Got it.
Players went from Marcus Burley to whoever else you want to name. It's happened many, many times. They've traded or whatever. But on players they've actually spent a draft pick on, it's been a very different story.
Okay, the last player who seems to be a common pick for the Seahawks in mock drafts, Florida State safety Derwin James.
Yeah, I'm going to go a little bit contrarian here in that I think he tested really well. I would say that we should not call him some kind of transcendent, tremendous athlete. He tested really, really well, and he'd be one of the more fun safeties in the league. I don't think he's some kind of transcendent talent. It's tough for me to take a safety that early if you don't think they are everything. But all of that being said, I think he's actually in a position-independent world. If you were not a safety, if you're playing corner or playing a position people thought was more critical, he's a top 10 type player when you can combine the talent and the athleticism. So while I want to put the brakes on him being some kind of transcendent athlete who's going to, be the best safety in the league, it's pretty exciting. Now, I will say the Seahawks have traditionally not valued athleticism in their safeties. It may be their least athletic position overall. And so I would be somewhat surprised to see them break that mold, although I would actually find it to be pretty exciting because just on a pure aesthetic level, having watched some college football, and he's a really exciting playmaker. And it would be really fun to have, kind of a big defensive name drafted there because for a long time they've kind of had the set LOB in their lineup. And it's been a while since they've kind of added a name on-brand player from one of the big schools. So in that regard, it would be fun. But from their past of drafting safeties and what prototype they go after and when they draft them, I would be somewhat surprised if see that pick be a safety.
Is he somebody who we think, given we don't know what will happen with Earl Thomas, but is he somebody who could play alongside Earl Thomas? Would they to both be here?
So I think it's interesting. What they're doing with Bradley McDougald, I think, is very different than what they've done in the past with Cam Chancellor. And so I almost wonder if what they've done with Cam is more specific to Cam itself, because Bradley McDougald is more of a strong safety, free safety type, maybe in like that Malcolm Jenkins role where you can kind of do little bits of both. So I would not think the Derwin James and Earl Thomas are incongruous at all. It does seem to me, though, that if they are picking Derwin James, it's because Earl Thomas is, a Dallas Cowboy or anything else that's not a Seattle Seahawk. But it would seem to be pretty surprising for them to have Derwin and Earl on the same team.
So you would see that if somehow the Seahawks were to draft him as a sign that a trade was coming?
I would think so. I mean, how much can they invest at safety? Right. It feels like if they spend 5 picks last year, they're paying Candace on the bench, they're paying Earl, and they're drafting Derwin at 18. If they haven't traded Earl, that means they don't have any other high picks. And if they've drafted Derwin James, that means they've picked pretty high. So they've basically said, we're going to pick this safety, we're going to have Earl and Derwin James, and we're going to have no picks until, whatever it is, 110 or 115. That would seem to me to be a fairly aggressive move that I would be pretty dang surprised by.
So one last player I thought was worth discussing from a Seahawks perspective, even though he's not going to be a candidate for the first round pick like these other guys, is someone I think many Seahawks fans would love to see them draft, the brother of Shaquille Griffin, Shakeem Griffin from Central Florida.
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously really biased here. Love his story. I don't know if people watched Central Florida all last year, but if you didn't, you missed out because he's one of those players where you watch and it's like he's almost at a different speed on the field. And he was everywhere for them. I think he's awesome. He tested out really, really well. He's basically a spitting image of Deion Jones, the Atlanta Falcons linebacker. But he has one hand. And so how teams rate that and who thinks they can make him a scheme fit is going to be everything. Now, I'll tell you, though, I think that the Seahawks have invested a ton in special teams over the last few years and haven't gotten a ton out of it. I mean, they've traded fifth-round picks. They've used roster spots on special teams guys instead of depth at other positions. I think a fourth or fifth round pick, if you think you have a star special teamer for 4 years, is worth it. So for me, he's projected to go in the fourth or fifth round. I see that as completely worthwhile, even if you think he never works out at linebacker, even if there's never a future there. just his ability on special teams alone, they've shown they're willing to pay that. You know, they paid a fifth round pick for 1 year, I believe, Kelsey McCray, before re-signing him. So if it would be inconsistent to me, I think, if you value him as a special teamer, not to spend something in that fourth or fifth round range on him. And I'll say, he doesn't. I don't know how to evaluate. He doesn't have a hand. That's incredibly difficult for me. I'm not an expert here. I don't know if anyone knows. It's kind of a new situation. But it would be really, really exciting to see them try.
It would be very awesome to have both Shaq Griffins on the field at the same time. It would be very confusing referring to them. We have to finally go with the Quill nickname, the Quill versus Keem nicknames.
I think we can figure it out. I don't think that's too difficult.
You can figure it out. So before we move on talking about more local players, is there anybody else to you, Zach, either spark-wise or mock-wise, anybody kind of who's in this range for the Seahawks first pick that you're interested in or you'd like to see them draft?
To me, I would be pretty disappointed if they stayed at 18. They just don't have enough picks otherwise, and they chose that path, right? They decided to go this way. They decided to trade the second and third round pick. They decided to go through with the Dwayne Brown trade, even when Jeremy Lane's physical failed and they had to add the pick. So this is the bet they made. They're going to have to lie in it. And I just don't see a way where they get a really cohesive draft out with one pick in the range. Before the middle part of the fourth round, you can get pretty good players. After the middle part of the fourth round, there's still players out there, but the hit rate is really, really low. And so I don't see how they go in and they only have one pick. So I honestly have not gotten emotionally attached to anybody in the 18 range because I think it'd be pretty irresponsible for them to draft there.
And it does seem like a lot of the players that we mentioned, talked about are really kind of mocked more in that late 20s, early 30s range more than the late teens.
Right. Yeah. I think people are baking in the trade down right already. But I like a lot of those names. I mean, if they end up with any of these guys, I'd be pretty excited. My fear is they do the 2014 and they trade down too far, where they traded down. And eventually they got Paul Richardson, which looked pretty bad for two and a half years. ended up having a nice year, obviously last year in Seattle. But they traded so far down that year that it felt like there was kind of a drop in talent level from that class, you know, around the 45 or 50 mark. I would like to see them trade down into the 30s. It would be tough, just the same as it would be hard to have your first pick at 18 and your second pick at 115. It would be really hard for me to see them have their first pick at, you know, 55. It's really tough when you don't get anybody from the first, you know, real first tier of talent. So I think my ideal situation would be drafting or trading back somewhere, maybe to the 33, maybe to 35 in that range, picking up a late second, early third, picking up a late third potentially at some point, and trying to fill that out a little bit.
One player who could potentially be on the board at 18, but probably will go a little bit ahead of that, is UW defensive tackle Vita Vea.
I love Vita Vea. I will relish what he did to Luke Falk for the rest of my life in that last Apple Cup. He was taking on two blockers in every play. I was getting drunk tweets from friends, Wazoo fans, about who is this Vita Vea guy. I mean, I will never forget that experience. But by the same token, I don't think you should be spending a top 10 pick on a nose tackle in the NFL. Doesn't make a ton of sense to me. And so I would be deeply disappointed if they decided the right move to fix the roster was to trade up for a defensive lineman. And I don't think Vita Vea, we know his play. I don't think he's a zero from a pass rushing impact. But he is not a significant factor play all three downs. And that would be really tough for me. I do think he's going to be awesome at what he does. But it'll come down to, do we think that any nose tackle with any level of play, like if you get Haloti Ngata, what is that player worth? Is that player worth a number 5 overall? Is it worth a number 8 overall? And I think that's an open question. It really comes down to how you value the pass game and the run game. And obviously there's a lot of different thoughts in Seahawks land about how we should value those. Yeah.
How do you think he compares as a prospect to Danny Shelton?
So he didn't test out, but we expected really high results out of him. You know, what you hear out of the UW facilities is he's a really, really strong athlete, would have been super explosive, would have had a great showing. So I think he's much more explosive than Danny Shelton. I mean, I've watched both of them obviously a lot at UW, and I think Danny was an awesome player and very prototypical in the run stuffing role, where he did more at UW, but you know, in more of a college three tech sense than someone's gonna project. I think Vita Vea is gonna be better. I think he has more upfield ability. I think he's faster, more explosive, more fast twitch. And probably even stronger. I mean, I think he's a better player. It is simply a matter that I don't think he's the right fit high in the draft that holds me there. I think that relative to almost any nose tackle over the last few drafts, he's really exemplary, super talented. And I hope he goes somewhere fun that's not in the NFC West, because I do not want to face him.
Yeah, historically, anytime there's a prospect we really liked from UW, they've either gone to the Cardinals or the Packers, I think.
That checks out. It's 100%.
Yeah. Next up from the Huskies at wide receiver, Dante Pettis.
Yeah, also didn't test. I will tell you that his Dominator, or his Phenom Index and Dominator rating, those are the advanced wide receiver metrics, are pretty good. Not great by any means, but not disqualifying. I think he's a fun player. I would be pretty reticent to draft him in the second round, like he's getting selected. I really wish he would have tested, because his junior day numbers at UW were insane. One of the best short shuttle agility types of all time. The numbers that were coming out of the junior day combines were historically great. So it's a bummer that we didn't see more from him, and that he, you know, was too hurt with the ankle injury he picked up in the Apple Cup.
Someone who's maybe moved up draft boards, it seems like, a little unexpectedly, tight end Will Dissly.
So I do love Will Dissly. I mean, again, this is where it becomes hard for me to take away the emotional aspect, because I'm not sure if I enjoyed watching any Husky run down the field as much as William Dissly. That dude was awesome. I mean, it was great, because Browning would drop back and he would see Dissly wide open, and there was the emotional thing of, why is he passing to that guy? Why is an offensive lineman downfield? Why is a defensive lineman downfield? Why is a tight end wearing 98? But then you'd see him catch the ball, and he really had kind of a zap to it, you know, and you get excited because he'd be carrying dudes. So I'm actually pretty excited about him. I forget where he was going in the last mock I saw. Yeah, he's like in the 6th, 7th round, and the Seahawks have taken real care to spend more than a 6th, 7th round pick on a blocking tight end. You know, hello, Nick Vanette. So if they felt like, you know, they want to spend one of those picks on Will Dissly, I'd be pretty excited. He's beefy, he's big, he's long, and I think he was pretty surprising on the ball while being a really dedicated blocker, and that's the kind of player the Seahawks are really good at utilizing. Now, that's not a player I'd really draft before the 6th round, but, you know, if they feel like that's what they want to spend their super late picks on, 6th round picks are really not much more than an undrafted free agent, so I'd be pretty happy. And again, we could... The real bummer, though, is he wouldn't wear 98 for the Seahawks. That would be clutch. He could keep the defensive lineman number, because I think that was probably half the emotional impact of his play, was just seeing him run now with the big old 9-8.
I'm taking your saying you were most excited to see him run with the football as an insult to Sivan Ahmed. I just want to note that for the record.
Okay, well, we didn't see Sivan Ahmed enough, as has been covered on the Pelton cast, I believe, at length. So I feel like, okay, this is wrong, but emotionally, I feel like Will Dissly touched the ball roughly 50 times as much as Salman.
Checks out.
Well, he's already been converted from defense to offense, so the Seahawks won't have to do that. He's been pre-converted for them, so that's kind of nice. Another player who actually did touch the ball quite a lot at UW, and LeVon Coleman.
LeVon Coleman did not test out super well, kind of middle of the road, nothing super special, didn't pop in any way. It is somewhat hard to see him making a huge impact. It feels like, seems most like a camp body, I guess, to anyone else. And I'm not sure he ever felt like a really strong NFL prospect at any point during his career, at least to me.
Yeah, it did feel like he did have maybe a little more buzz had he gone out after his junior year, when he was more effective in that backup role behind Myles Gaskin. Three other Huskies who have a chance to potentially get drafted: Coleman Shelton, Azeem Victor, and Kishon Bieria.
Yeah, so Azeem Victor probably tested the best of all the Huskies. It was not a good year for Husky testing, because the two best athletes in the squad by a stretch were Pettis and Bea, who obviously didn't test. Victor is not overaged, which is nice, and he tested out kind of right in line with close to the league average. Same with Coleman Shelton at center. Bieria was a pretty bad tester overall, in addition to only being 230 pounds and also running a 4.79. That seems like a pretty tough thing to climb. Victor was at 240 pounds at 4.72, which is not fast, but it's kind of in the spectrum of NFL athletes. But a 230-pound linebacker, you kind of figure they need to be pretty fast, pretty sudden. And not only is Bieria pretty slow, he's really quite small, 6 foot, short arms, just in general kind of feels like more of a college build, and it'd be somewhat surprising to see him take on a big NFL role.
Let's wrap it up with the player you mentioned that Villavea was driving to the turf repeatedly during the Apple Cup, WSU quarterback Luke Falk.
Yeah, Luke Falk is one of two combine quarterbacks to not test. Obviously, he had the wrist thing that was hidden for most of last year. Classic Mike Leach deal. I will tell you, though, I'm reporting live from the trenches of draft Twitter, and people have turned on Luke Falk.
Interesting.
It's not pretty. People are throwing things, and they're not footballs. It's interesting because even just before last season, people were talking about him as a second-round pick, late first-round pick, up there with, you know, not guys like Rosen, but in kind of that tier below. And it really feels like the bottom's fallen out. And it's sad because maybe if he comes out early, this doesn't happen. But, I mean, he looked pretty bad at in various points over the pre-draft process. At the combine, people were kind of like, oh, he's on target, but he was consistently throwing almost every ball. And really, obviously, he didn't have a great year at quarterback there. I mean, the Cougs kind of had him in and out. It feels like he's more on the Jeff Toole road than the actual NFL quarterback road.
We discussed at length before the Apple Cup how the WSU offense was not nearly as effective as their defense when you adjusted for the number of plays they run over the course of a game. And that's not super encouraging, I think, for Falk's chances in the NFL.
Right. They were not a good passing offense, and that seems like a problem.
I was trying to dig up the tweet about, you know, I just favor the team with the better quarterback, and that's why I think WSU is going to win the Apple Cup from a couple of years ago.
Oh, that I believe was Nathan Ernst, if we want to make sure he gets the proper shade.
An all-time classic for sure. So, Zach, is there anything else Seahawks fans and Husky fans should know going into this year's draft?
No, I mean, it's going to be pretty exciting, right? They have no draft capital, but we're all used to that, so this is nothing new. And, you know, I think we can all hope that they just get someone as exciting, someone as thrilling, someone who gets the fan base going as past, you know, stars like Christian Michael.
Any day now, Christian Michael is going to break out. I think as we kind of alluded to at the beginning of this, I feel like I have not followed the draft process nearly as closely this year, partially because of the fact that, as Tristan grieved about last week, the following the Seahawks at this point seems like a chore this offseason, or, you know, something painful to do. So I guess the idea of barring an Earl Thomas trade, the fact that they'll simply be adding players to the roster over this week and not subtracting anyone we love, may just all by itself be a comparatively quite positive experience for Seahawks fans.
This is such famous last words.
I know.
Russell Wilson's getting traded during this draft.
This is going to go on the Pelton Cast 200. The 200th episode. We're going to talk about how you thought nothing bad was going to happen, and they're going to trade Russell Wilson. They're going to trade Earl Thomas. Cam Chancellor's going to play quarterback without being able to move. And you're going to sit back and you're going to realize it was all your fault because you suggested something might not be bad.
You're right. I don't know what I was thinking. Everything is bad. Everything.
Okay.
The best draft in Seahawks history. Oh my god.
Oh no.
Covered last week in Seattle sports history tweet.
It's all true. It's all been downhill from there.
can we expect you back after the draft, Zach, as we did last year, to look back on what was?
Let me tell you what. If the proposed thing, if Russell Wilson and Earl Thomas are not both traded, and Cam Chancellor is not named the starting quarterback, from whatever kind of, I don't know, I don't even know if he's allowed to be on a football field now. Maybe he'd have to have kind of some support, some crutches, a wheelchair. I'm not sure what the situation would be. Then I will come on the podcast. But if all of that happens, I cannot promise because I'll probably be, I don't know, in Ziwataneho or whatever. I don't think I'll be following much more of the Seahawks offseason.
We'll talk about Westworld if that happens.
We'll be podcasting exclusively about the Philadelphia 76ers at that point, I think.
Well, this is a Philadelphia 76ers right. podcast, right? Because, you know, I have been a lifelong Sixers fan. You know, my biggest regret in life is when the Sixers lost to the enemy Portland Trailblazers in the 1977 finals. That's something that really internalized to me, you know, those damn Blazers. The Sixers really should have one more title. And it's really, I want to get revenge back on the bad guys, like the Portland Trailblazers, as a lifelong Sixers fan.
It's the best part about this, you are a lifelong Portland Trailblazers fan. You're to pretend ones. This is even better for when next week, when I claim to also be a lifelong Sixers fan.
I will tell you, I did not react well to this series. I I was at a watch party on game two. After the three-pointer from Rondo at the end of the game, I stood up and walked out really without saying goodbye. It's been a bad week sports-wise, so yeah, it is tender. But as Ben Simmons is now the only player I've ever known in basketball, I have forgotten the Blazers. I've forgotten the 2000 Western Conference Finals Game 7 where Brian Shaw banked in a three-pointer at the end of the third quarter and led to a precipitous decline where Tim Donaghy comprehensively screwed over an entire city. So after all of that, really, it feels good to be a Sixers fan, guys. We'll just wait till Earl Thomas is traded this week. Oh, God.
I mean, maybe we'll have to trust the process for the Seahawks.
Wow, man, the bottom really does fall out.
This is good, though. We're setting expectations low. This is a much better place for us to finish.
They could not be lower.
On that note, thanks so much for joining us, Zach, and thanks for listening.
Thanks.